58 Kenosha, 70 Racine, 62 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We have three different interviews for you on today's morning show, including one on the English language and how it is used by those who engage in spin. We'll talk to one of the authors of a book called Spinglish. Also, we're going to be hearing this hour from a group of young people from Northern Illinois who specialize in the upbeat music of Broadway, inspired by Jersey Boys. They have a big performance coming up this weekend. All this and more coming up on The Morning Show here on WGTD. We're going to be engaging in some fun wordplay over the next few minutes of the morning show as I speak with Henry Beard, one of the two authors responsible for a new book called Spinglish, the Definitive Dictionary of Deliberatively Deceptive Language. It is a book which helps us understand in more detail and in sort of fun fashion how we sometimes even inadvertently use language to slightly disguise what in fact we really mean. And of course, it is something that spin doctors who work on behalf of politicians and others do all the time in much more conscious fashion. And the book takes us from English into Spinglish and Spinglish into English and really sort of takes some of this apart in really delightful fashion. The guest I'm speaking to, one of the co-authors, Henry Beard, is a co-founder of National Lampoon and served as the magazine's editor for a number of years. And he has a whole bunch of delightful books to his credit, including the Pentagon Catalog, the Book of Sequels, and the Officially Politically Correct Dictionary and Handbook. This book, again, is called Spinglish. And Henry Beard, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. Spinglish?
Yep, Spinglish. We put a hyphen in there, so it wouldn't sound like Spanglish, but it's really, as you had said, it's treating spin as a particular subset of the English language.
Right. You call it the, this book is a means by which to master the devious vocabulary of verbal distortion. That's a very elegant way to phrase it. Maybe we could start with the purpose that is typically behind Spinglish. And I think most of the time when we talk about spin doctors and putting spin on something via this kind of verbal distortion, we tend to think of it pretty negatively as something that is done typically with devious intent, for one's own gain at the expense of others or whatever. I suspect you would say that the picture is a little more complicated than that, and sometimes Spinglish is used for more admirable or noble means or intents.
Yeah, Greg, I think you're absolutely right. You know, when Chris Cerf and I did the Official Politically Correct Dictionary Handbook a few years back, which got us starting thinking about language in this way, with politically correct speech, you could say it's a kind of spin. You're trying to not hurt people's feelings. Somebody isn't fat, they're Rubenesque, they're not short, they're vertically challenged. But the kind of spin that we have in Spinglish, spin words, really is most of the time an attempt to to deceive. I mean, whether it's a politician trying to get your vote or a company trying to sell you a product, Wall Street trying to hide some shenanigans, even a real estate agent trying to convince you to buy an absolute dump for an inflated price, it mostly is distortion. It mostly is a deliberate effort, even when it sounds nice, to mislead you.
One of the things you say in the book's introduction I think is really worth talking about is this. Any language can be used to convey or conceal all sorts of meanings and messages, but English is unparalleled in its capacity for creative misdirection. And you go on to spell out a couple of its, in your words, unique linguistic features which make this true. Explain why English is, on the one hand, I was going to say susceptible, especially susceptible to this, and on the other hand, someone who likes to use Spinglish would use different terminology, would say it's a fertile ground for Spinglish and all that one can accomplish with it. What is it about English?
Well, the several remarkable things about English. First off, it has a million words, which is astonishing. A lot of other languages, particularly ones that have something like the Academie Française that tries to keep the language pure, have fewer than 100,000. Also, English is spoken by about a billion people, so it's as close as you're going to come to a universal language. But more importantly, it's at its heart, it basically consists of two sub-languages, Anglo-Saxon and Latin. And Anglo-Saxon gave us words like, kill, lie, and cheat. Latin gives us terminate with extreme prejudice, obfuscate, and engage in commercial misdirection. So always in language, there's an entire way to get your point across in a much more subtle way, so you don't have to say what you're really doing.
Another thing I think is important to talk about, again, this is in the book's introduction, is what you say is the importance of distinguishing between slang and jargon. And this is there's two terms that I think many of us use quite interchangeably. What is your understanding of slang and jargon, and why is it important to distinguish between those two terms in better understanding something like Spinglish?
Well, slang, start with slang. Slang tends to be spontaneous. Nobody's, decided to come up with the term jalopy to describe, an old car. It probably comes from India. English is great language at absorbing without any hesitation any word that seems to fit and provides a means of communication that wasn't there already. Jargon tends to arise just out of the natural process of people working together. Now, sometimes it's deceptive. It isn't always deceptive, but sometimes it's. Here's an example. There is a term used by the police for subduing an unruly suspect by banging him over the back of the head with a flashlight, and that term, a form of jargon, is aluminum shampoo. Now, there is a certain misleading quality in using a term like aluminum shampoo instead of beating the dude with a flashlight.
Well said. Well played. So tell us about the construction of the sort of core of this book, the part of this book which in effect is a glossary that takes us through the language, through English into Spinglish and back again. Tell us how you and your co-author put this part of the book together.
Well, it's interesting. We basically took great advantage of the Internet because it would be almost, not impossible, but very difficult to research this stuff in a library trying to find this book or that book. So with the Internet, we started off with, a very common, particularly Pentagon terms, like terminate with extreme prejudice instead of kill, and incontinent ordnance for a bomb that landed on a hospital instead of an artillery emplacement. And as you go through, God bless Google, the area of inquiry immediately expands, and you see you find that a term that you thought was actually originally used by the Pentagon is actually now being used by Wall Street or by Hollywood or whatever. In the process, we must have come up with over 2,000 examples, and we have almost 100 pages of tiny type footnotes to make it clear where each and every word came from. We didn't make any of these up. I mean, some of them are so insane, you think that somebody must have sat down and made them up, and somebody did make them up, but not for the purpose of getting a laugh, which was what we would have done. So it is a legitimate collection. As you say, the vast majority of the book is a glossary of Spinglish terms and what they really mean. And a smaller thing is the English to Spinglish, where it gives you a chance to use spin for your benefit. So, for example, if you're goofing off in the office and somebody says, "You're goofing off," you say, "No, I was zero tasking."
Another favorite term of mine is ambulation, which is, I mean, that's certainly not a made-up word or a made-up phrase. It's a real word. But, of course, ambulation, your definition, an impressive-sounding medical term that means simply walking.
Walking.
The word is commonly used by doctors when they prescribe strolling up and down hospital corridors as a therapeutic activity. We probably do that quite a lot, especially in certain arenas where we are important to dress up very ordinary activities with fancy-sounding words.
No, we are absolutely right. And, of course, the medical world also comes up with a different kind of subterfuge. If you find a charge on your bill for, like, $50 for a mucus recovery system, that would be a box of Kleenex.
On a more serious note, the very first page of the first half of the glossary, for instance, talks about the term abuse. And the very first word of your definition of what in Spinglish the word abuse actually means is?
Torture.
Torture.
Especially when it's conducted by the United States or its allies. And, you know, it comes from then Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld, who was responding to a reporter's question about photographs showing U.S. troops clearly torturing prisoners at Abu Ghraib. Russell said, "I'm not a lawyer. My impression is that what has been charged thus far is abuse, which I believe technically is different from torture. I don't know if it is correct to say that what you just said, that torture is second place, and therefore I'm not going to address the torture word."
Troubling.
It is troubling. And, of course, remember, it's not just abuse. We can now say enhanced interrogation technique, pain compliance techniques, repetitive administration of legitimate force, special methods of questioning, and stress and duress tactics.
Right. Another term in here at one point that is maybe at a glance kind of funny, but it's sort of scary on the other hand, too, is a term in the L section of the first glossary, least untruthful. Least untruthful. You tell us about a Senate hearing in 2013 when this was utilized by someone who was testifying, and the person who had was thought to have delivered some very untruthful testimony, or at least testimony that was not spelling out the facts as was requested. Upon being confronted by NBC's Andrea Mitchell, you tell us he responded that what he thought under the circumstances was the least untruthful manner possible. I mean, it's really scary to think about people in this world operating under that system, and there's probably a whole lot of people for whom that makes a really terrible sort of sense.
Yeah, this is an extreme example. You know, James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, basically, he was forced to admit that he lied. But as you say, calling a lie the least untruthful response is just amazing. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And that's why I say it was so interesting for us to do the research and to come across things like this, which the first time you read them, you're just stunned. You think this can't possibly be true. But then, you know, the more you see, the more you realize it's everywhere.
Right. Explain how the book has, in effect, two glossaries. And I think what we've just been reading from is the first one, in which we talk about certain items of Spinglish, like legitimate rape, or it came out wrong, mistakes were made, and then you define that in plain old clear English. Explain to our listeners the second glossary that is in this book.
Well, this is the one that is English to Spinglish. So it lets you see in very clear terms how a very common term has been completely rotated so that you won't recognize it. The best example I can give you is there are more than 40 synonyms, misleading synonyms for firing somebody. For example, just a quick rundown. You attrition, you Bangalore, you decruit, you dehire, you deinstall, you deselect, you excess, you future endeavor, you involuntarily leisure, you let go, you make available to the industry, you make redundant, you manage for value, you non-renew, you offer a package to them, you outplace, you present with an early retirement opportunity, you send into phased retirement, you severance, you surplus, you unassign.
Or my favorite, engage in workforce imbalance rectification.
This stuff is just, and again, you come across this stuff, and yeah, get lean and mean, implement a skills mix adjustment, increase one's use of vacancy management, initiate a career alternative enforcement program. I mean, it's just amazing.
So particularly in this case, what do you think is going on there? What is it that keeps one from using the term fire, even when nothing holds you back from firing someone? What is it about saying that word or using that word which is so unpleasant that one resorts to this kind of Spinglish instead?
Well, every company, just about every company, companies hate to admit that they're firing people. And it's one thing to say, I fired this person because I caught him, you know, shoplifting. But most of the downsizing we see is companies that are finding ways to increase their profits by limiting their labor force, sometimes by putting machines to work instead of people, but usually by sending their job to India or Mexico or Vietnam, something like that. So the company, for just simple public relations purposes, does not want to be perceived as doing what it is actually doing for fear that people will start saying, well, let's boycott them, or you know, why should I buy stuff from them? So they make it sound like it's a very positive process, very natural, very scientific, when in fact it's just bottom line.
So by and large, where did these come from? How many of them sprang from actual real-world examples versus just from the fertility of your own imaginations?
Every single one of them is a real-world example. We didn't make up a single one of these, as tempting as it might have been. And after a while in the process of accumulating this stuff, we realized, first of all, we didn't need to make this stuff up because there was so much of it. And second of all, we couldn't possibly come up with stuff that was more florid and ridiculous and to our eye, at least, transparently full of, shall we say, dairy nutrients than the stuff that we already found.
Right, which explains the almost 100 pages of notes towards the back of the book, which in a sense are the footnotes of this book, in which you spell out exactly where you drew each and every one of these examples of Spinglish. Let's finish by giving you an opportunity to tell us one of your favorites that we haven't yet mentioned in the book, in this interview.
Well, this is one we just stumbled across, and it'll have to go into the next edition. It, a community, a suburb that was overrun by deer, and I live in such a place, didn't want to announce that it was going to kill a deer. So they said that they were initiating a program of human-directed mortality. That's just really amazing.
And kind of
and
chilling.
Well, it is a little chilling, isn't it? We also like the terms like for your convenience, which of course means for our convenience. For your convenience, stand outside for an hour in the cold rain while our employees have a lunch break. Or your call is important to us, but not important enough to hire people to answer it, so you'll be on hold for 35 minutes.
Right. Well, the book again is called Spinglish, the Definitive Dictionary of Deliberately Deceptive Language. It is published by Blue Rider Press and co-authored by Henry Beard. And there are all kinds of delights and lots of food for thought in this book as well. Henry Beard, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show, and thank you for helping to create this really intriguing and interesting book.
Greg, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And the time is exactly 8:30. You're listening to The Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Part two of The Morning Show is coming up in just a moment. A little later in the hour, we're going to hear from some very talented young people from Northern Illinois who together are called Project 2 Music. We have a very special performance coming up this weekend. Our weather forecast today is for partly sunny skies. We're headed for a high temperature today of 78 degrees. Here's part two of today's Morning Show. And we're going to spend this next portion of WGTD's Morning Show, and not very much, I'm afraid of it. Our time is very limited, but I'm thankful for at least a few minutes to talk with Josh Sundquist, a young man who has quite an exceptional story. Perhaps you know him from his YouTube channel and from some of the writing that he's done, particularly in a previous bestseller called Just Don't Fall. Josh Sundquist happens to be someone who has... who lives his life with one leg, essentially, but that does not slow him down. And he is an inspiring figure on a whole lot of different levels. He's written a new memoir called We Should Hang Out Sometime, Embarrassingly a True Story, in which Josh Sundquist goes about reconnecting with some of the females in his life whom he pursued and hoped to have as girlfriends, none of whom ultimately... accepted the invitation, and he reconnects with each and every one of them to sort of retrace his steps through some of those romantic mishaps, shall we say. This book is published by Little Brown and Company, and it's an absolute delight. And Josh Sundquist, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Hey, thank you so much, Greg. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
One of the things I think it's the very first chapter in the book where you talk about one of these first... girls who figures prominently in your life when you are still, I think, maybe just in middle school or high school, but you touch briefly on the matter of losing your leg. You lost it to cancer. It sounds from what we read that, although this book is not directly about that, but obviously figures prominently, but it sounds like, for the most part, if such a story can be a happy story or a positive story, it seems like it is been such a positive story for you. That is, you're part of a family that loves you and have been really surrounded by peers who have really shown you a lot of kindness and support. Can you just say a quick word about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I couldn't have asked for better family or friends, as you said. You know, when I had cancer, I think having parents who love each other, who love me, was tremendously helpful, and having friends who, when I lost my hair to chemotherapy, I had 18 friends shave their heads for me, you know, and just having that sort of support when you're going through something like that, I think makes all the difference, and it certainly made all the difference for me.
Well, for as positive as your life has been, you have not done terribly well when it comes to the matter of girlfriends. Did anything in particular prompt you to... circle back to revisit probably some experiences that most people would like to leave back in the distant recesses of memory and if possible, just as soon forget? You actually wanted to kind of confront some of these disappointments in your life. Why was that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I guess it was two things, mostly just curiosity. You know, I didn't really know, why have I never had a girlfriend? You know, I've tried to date a lot, and you know, otherwise seem to be a relatively well-adjusted, normal kind of person. And secondly, you know, I was hoping maybe I could learn some things, you know, maybe make corrective actions if there was, like, some overall trend of, you know, behavior that was, you know, throwing things off, or that people identified as, like, oh, this is why I didn't like you, or this is why we never dated. So I think those were the driving factors as to why I started the investigation.
you write in such wonderful fashion. And I don't remember who it was that I was talking to, and I hope you won't mind this comparison, but somebody said you remind them of David Sedaris, but with a lot more truth. That is the, I think I'm sure a lot of public radio listeners, of course, know that name well and probably really enjoy what he does. But, of course, there's a very fuzzy line in terms of how much of this really happened and how much of this springs from his fertile imagination. I get the sense, yeah, as funny as this book is, that what you're telling us is absolutely real, sometimes achingly real, sometimes hilariously real, but absolutely real.
Yeah, I try to. I've written two memoirs now, and I think this is going to be. I'm working on a novel now, and the reason is because I want to keep writing. But yeah, I feel like I've said everything I can say about my life, and I don't want to move into that sort of vaguely made up memoir genre that certain unknown authors or authors we will not name tend to write in. So yeah, these are absolutely true stories, and I guess that makes it all the more awkward sometimes that these are really things that happened and really conversations I had.
Right. One of the things that's an interesting hallmark of the book is that there are a lot of visual representations, sort of charts and graphs. It's a little hard to describe what they are. I mean, like, for instance, in this first chapter about Sarah Stevens, that very first almost girlfriend, you chart how much I talked to Sarah Stevens and before we were going out, and it's a line that's kind of halfway up the box, and then this dotted line bisects the chart after we were going out, and the line plunges down. And
yeah,
and that's just one of many that are in the book. Did you do those, and why did you think that was an interesting and helpful thing to include?
Yeah, I did. Those are my charts. It's just I really approach my life that way, from a very analytical and I don't know if you would necessarily say mathematical standpoint, but I love data visualization, and I love, I don't know, it's just the way I think about decisions is I just see charts in my mind. And so, you know, in making this sort of investigation into girls and then trying to explain my life and the things with girls, it was sort of a natural extension of my voice to add these graphs, and I think it adds an insight, but also it's hopefully a lot of times they're just sort of funny, and it's just kind of funny to see because it's all relatable. I think everybody's been in these sorts of relationship situations, and to see them like a pie chart of that or a line graph of that, I think it's kind of a fun way of looking at that.
Right. One of my favorites in the whole book is one. The title of the graph is Usefulness of Math. And then you have the one bar, getting A's, and it stretches up to the top, getting girls, and the bar goes the other way, kind of into the negative territory. So that's the helpfulness of math. Say a word about how these various women welcomed or failed to welcome your sort of reapproachment to them, in some cases after a number of years had gone by. And say a little bit about what it was like to how did you even word the invitation?
It was definitely really terrifying because you're essentially attempting to get people to give you negative feedback about yourself, right? So that's a very scary thing to do. But, I tried to approach it from, a very, sort of gentle and humble way, saying, hey, this was 10 years ago. It's not like a big emotional thing anymore. I'm not upset about it or anything. I'm in a good place psychologically. But I'm just kind of curious, and I'm just kind of trying to learn a little bit about myself and my past. So if you would be willing to share any insight about this, that'd be great. But if not, totally understand. Obviously you have no obligation to share this with me. And so I try to approach it from that standpoint. And I was pleasantly surprised that, in most cases, people were really, really generous with kind of sharing their insights and their kind of here's what I was thinking during that situation. And oftentimes it was, quite different than what I was thinking or what I thought she was thinking in that situation. And so that was a sort of big learning point for me. But yeah, people were really were very receptive to it, actually.
Right. I hope you won't mind this question. I assume that it wasn't after the fact. It was they were all sort of one and the same. That you thought this would be great fodder for a book? I mean, this.
No, I don't mind that question. And yeah, a lot of people will assume that. No, I actually just started the investigation as a very dramatic and intense self-improvement project. It wasn't for the purpose of writing a book. And then sort of after the fact, after I did eventually find a girlfriend, and now I'm pleased to report that we're engaged, then my literary agent was like, hey, I know you've had a lot of these problems dating over the years, but now that you have sort of a happy ending, like, this could be a really cool book. And so then I wrote the story about it. But no, it wasn't. A lot of memoirs, set out to like do something interesting, to write a book or whatever. But no, it was more just, I kind of wanted to know.
Huh. Well, that probably made it ultimately a much more authentic experience. The last quick question: you early in the book recount your two sort of rules about living as you do: never be a burden, never be different. How much have you been able to step away from those two rules that really governed a lot of your actions and choices early on in life? Once you lost your leg.
Those were like kind of my rules of how I dealt with being an amputee and being different. I would say that those rules, for better or for worse, are still something that I use and sort of follow. Sometimes to my detriment. I think my fiance said, when she read the book, like that was really insightful to her, that explained a lot of like how I think and how I behave to her, because obviously what the rules are, they're an overcompensation for the reality that sometimes I do need help. Sometimes I have to be a burden on other people, and I am different. Like, that's a fact, right? So those are just sort of overcorrection to try to be fit in when I can, to try not to be stared at too much, and to try not to like be too much of a burden on people.
Hmm. It's a delightful book. I absolutely loved it, start to finish. I hope a lot of people will seek out We Should Hang Out Sometime, Embarrassingly a True Story by Josh Sundquist. And of course, you can also find out much more about him through his channel on YouTube. Josh Sundquist, I really enjoyed this. Very best wishes to you.
Hey, thanks, Greg. Really appreciate it.
The time is 8:42, and now part three of The Morning Show on WGTD. That spirited music making is from a group called Project 2 Music, based in Huntley, Illinois. And this is a talented group of young people who decided that they wanted to get together and make the music which they loved the most. Energetic, contemporary music from Broadway. And they have done so with escalating success over the last several years. And they have a big performance coming up this Saturday evening at 7:30 p.m. at Huntley High School Performing Arts Center. I'm pleased to be able to spend a couple of minutes talking today with two members of the group, Andrew Rewerts, who I happen to know as one of my voice students at Carthage College, who grew up in Huntley and is actually one of the original band members, part of Project 2 Music. And also on the line is Josh Rivera, who is one of the vocalists and directs marketing for the group, again called Project 2 Music. Andrew and Josh, we welcome both of you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thank you, Chris. Yep.
Good to be talking to you. Andrew, you were there just about at the very beginning. Tell us about the genesis of this group and about this talented friend of yours named Dylan Ladd, who really helped put this together from the start.
Sure. So Dylan Ladd, who is the leader of the group, he started in 2007 with the song Sherry and a group of friends when they were in middle school. They were singing, he had just seen the musical Jersey Boys and had fallen in love with it. he started to do this group, and they sang Sherry at a talent show, I believe it was. And they decided after the talent show and after great success to continue doing it, and they called themselves Jersey Kids. Well, there are legal issues with the name Jersey Kids because it's very similar to Jersey Boys. So the founders of the creators of Jersey Boys contacted him and said, hey, we love what you're doing. Just change your name and you'll be absolutely fine. We support you 100%. So they took a little bit of time off. And at the time they originally were doing it, they were doing it all with backing tracks. So they were going on iTunes and finding that music that way. But when they decided to add the to change the name, they decided to add a live band. So they added a live band, and I was one of the people that helped find a lot of the original instrumentalists, as well as our piano player, Diana Patsiga. So we found the band, and originally we put the name in as Project 2 Music because it was our second endeavor and it was supposed to be a placeholder. Well, then we bought a website and we got known more around the area. So we decided to stick with the name and we never ended up changing it.
So what was just sort of a temporary stopgap name became the permanent name. And I think you said before we went on the air that you were a sophomore in high school then when you came aboard as this live backup band was first organized.
Correct.
Josh, what about you? What is your history with the group? I think you have not been with it quite as long as Andrew.
Well, I grew up with a lot of my best friends being in the group and being into theater and band and choir. And I would enjoy going to see the shows, and I was actually felt like a roadie because I would help pack up the equipment and put in cars and take it with them and be with them after the shows, and it was a lot of fun. When one day they were in need of a drummer, and I played drums on the side for fun, and I had a secret audition in Dylan's basement, actually. They had me climb aboard, and since then I've been a drummer, and this season, this summer was the first summer where they brought me up from a drummer to the vocalist.
Wow. Yep. One of how many singers?
Five.
Right. So ahead of this, how much singing had you done in your life?
I mean, I've been in a couple bands that I started up with a couple friends where I sing backup vocals or I sing, you know, kind of rock style music. But I really enjoyed listening to Jersey Boys, and, you know, I never actually seen the musical, and I felt like all the stuff that Project 2 was doing was original. And it's catchy, and I love singing it, and sound well enough to be a part of the vocalist now.
Wow. Cool. Andrew, I know the group has played in some really exciting places and done some really cool things over the last few years. Just give our listeners a tiny sample of some of the places where you've played and performed and for what kinds of events.
Sure. We've done complete shows for almost 5 years in a row. This is the first year we're not. At the Huntley Del Webb for about, I think it's 400 people. Then we've also done two performances this year, and last year did one. At Six Flags Great America, we did five performances each day. That was always a lot of fun. We performed at the Arcata Theater in St. Charles. We've done performances in Lake Geneva, and we've done some other concerts in the parks, as well as some festivals throughout the Chicagoland area, including Italian festivals, and especially those since Frankie Valli was Italian, and that's our primary music.
Right. Talk a little bit about how the group functions. I mean, you've already mentioned that the young man who really founded the group, Dylan Ladd, leads the group, but I suspect that, you know, that it's been also a very collaborative kind of venture. How do you guys function in terms of all the things that need to get done and the decisions that have to be made? I mean, just a limitless number of things that have to be taken care of. How does the group function?
Well, we do a lot of kind of bonding things where we hang out outside of performances. And we're all, I think it's safe to say that we're all pretty good friends and we enjoy seeing each other. We all also have a lot of trust in Dylan for making a lot of executive decisions. and as well as our arranger slash bass player, Kyle Schneider, who's very experienced when it comes to music and arranging music and what sounds great and what to play for what people want to hear. When they worked together, they brought us big shows like Six Flags, Lake Geneva, St. Charles and the Arcata. That they're a good team. They work together well, and we have trust in them to get us big shows and good music to play and sing.
Hmm. Andrew, tell us about the importance of this performance that's coming up on Saturday night. Why are you especially anxious for people to come?
We are really excited and anxious for this performance because it's one of the first performances where we are doing everything. We haven't had in the past, usually for all of our performances, somebody hires us, such as Del Webb or Six Flags or the Arcata Theater. For this one, we rented the space. We put on the music. It's all stuff that we wanted to do. We didn't have any stipulations saying that this is what we absolutely want, this is what you have to do. For this, we are allowed to actually step back and say, let's create the best show that we want. So we, being that we're doing that, we are doing a full-out light show. We are doing a video, professional video of the entire concert for future people to be able to see for when they're wanting to hire us, and for other people that can't see us, for them to be able to see us if they're farther away. You know, so it's a great way for us also to be able to see ourselves and be able to, in the future, maybe help look and say, oh, we really liked what we did here, or we didn't really like what we did here, but it was still good, but we can improve on it. So it's a way for us to see what we want and for us to improve on what we have, as well as just being a first step out for us to be able to do everything ourselves and make the best show we know we could be.
Great. Andrew, how big is the band? You play Barry Sax. Who else joins you in the band?
So we we have a total of five horns on Saturday. We have two trumpets, one of which is joining us for this performance. The other one is our lead trumpet player, Amy Koch. We have a tenor sax named Brendan Chagrew and trumpet named Max Pearson. Also, then we have Kyle Schneider on bass guitar. We have Luke Dopke, who also attends Carthage College, on drum set. Diana Fitziga on piano. Chris Aceron on guitar. Elena Cruz Lopez on violin. And then we also have Emily Pauline on cello.
And then Josh, who joins you in terms of the singing? You said there's five of you. So is it three women, two guys?
It's three guys. It's myself. And for backup guys, it's myself and Tyler Darnell. And as you know, the lead singer, Dylan Ladd. As for the lead for girls, we have Miss Abby Gleason. And then behind her, she has Andriana Martinez, and also singing while playing piano is Diana. And Chris and Kyle also sing with us as backup vocalists.
It looks like from the lineup of songs that you're planning to perform on Saturday night that you guys are not only Jersey Boys fans, but also Motown fans.
Yes, very much.
Cool. So it looks like a energetic, exciting night, and I should think that one of the tricky things about a group like this that starts when you're all in high school but continues on when you're growing up and into your college years, that just getting together gets to be a little bit tricky. For the most part, is the group on hiatus through the school year and then you come back together in the summer?
For the most part, that's usually what it is. We do have a couple of performances here and there, and for those, everyone tries to come back, but sometimes it's very difficult. We have some people in Southern Illinois and University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, where it's a 4 to 5 hour drive back here. It can get a little difficult. It's not like the hour drive from here to Kenosha. So it can get difficult for some people. So for those, if we do have them, we usually pull in a backup group of instrumentalists that we have from around the area. We have a list of probably 30 or 40 instrumentalists that we could pull from. but we try keeping it in the group, and we don't always book perform. We try not to book them when we're at school, but sometimes we have people that have been following us since we started the group, and for those it's kind of hard to say to them, we've been to almost all of our concerts, and you want to hire us now, but we're at school, so we can't. So for those, we kind of make exceptions saying, we'll do them. You've been following us and supporting us for a long time. We'll be there. We
cool.
can do that.
Great, great. Josh, where do you go to school?
I currently attend Western Illinois University down in Macomb.
Cool. And studying what?
Business marketing.
Ah, so it makes sense that you are the marketing director for Project 2.
Some extra work on the side, huh?
Absolutely. Great real-life experience. And Andrew, you're, of course, a music major at Carthage College and very much amongst friends. So this performance of Project 2 Music is coming up this Saturday night, July 25th, at the Huntley High School Performing Arts Center. And Josh, what is the website if people want more information about your group or want to find out more information about Saturday night and tickets and so on?
All right. It's www.project2music.com, where you can find more information about the members, more information about upcoming shows, and you can also purchase your tickets through the website. We're also found on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, Project 2 Music.
Very good. Josh Rivera and Andrew Rewertz, great to talk with both of you. Good luck with your performance on Saturday night and everything beyond for Project 2 Music.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, what a night.
Project 2 Music, and the performance Saturday evening down in Huntley, Illinois. Tomorrow on the morning show, the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council and Nan Calvert. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You can find the morning show archived on our website, which is wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Now a look at our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. For today, we're going to have partly sunny skies and relatively mild or comfortable conditions with our high temperature today, 78 degrees. Tonight, we'll have partly cloudy skies. Our low will be right around 63 degrees. On Thursday and Friday as well, the forecast is for sunny skies and high temperatures right around 83, 84, maybe 85 degrees, both Thursday and Friday. Saturday will be partly sunny. However, in the forecast, there is now a 50% chance of rain, increased from 40%. That's been the forecast the last couple days. Now it looks like 50% chance of rain on Saturday with a high of 85 degrees. Partly sunny on Sunday, still a 30% chance of rain with a high of 82 degrees. Right now it looks like very pleasant conditions are in the extended forecast for early next week, both Monday and Tuesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.